And so we've discussed already the truth of our unsatisfactory experiences. In other words, that not everything in our life is satisfactory. And we started a couple of weeks ago the segment that talks about what are the causes of being in this situation. And so within that, there's a list of what they call the six root afflictions. And so far we've talked about clinging attachment as being an unrealistic, non-beneficial state of mind. Anger, ignorance, conceit, that's four. Doubt, deluded doubt, inclined towards the wrong idea. And then the sixth one is called afflictive views. And so afflictive views itself has five types. So we're in the middle of discussing these five types. I'll kind of start from number one again, just as a review. But before I do that, some people had sent in some questions, so I wanted to answer them. Okay, so one person writes, and he says, he's talking about his attachment, and he says, some of my attachments I justify. For example, the attachment I have towards my wife. I say things like, I love her, and therefore I should be attached to her. Or she is my wife of many years, and so I think attachment is just a given. I know these attachments are not healthy, but when I try to apply the antidote, my mind grasps even harder. What do you recommend in this stuck situation? Okay, that's the first part of the question. So I'm sure many other people have a similar kind of question and a similar difficulty. So it's helpful, you know, to know that attachment is a mental factor that is based on exaggerating the good qualities of someone or something. And then because we've exaggerated good qualities or we've projected good qualities that aren't there, then we don't want to be separated, in this case, from the person. Okay? And along with, you know, this exaggeration is a lot of unrealistic expectations of the person. You know, this person is so wonderful, I love them, they love me, therefore, and we have a lot of expectations that we don't even realize that we've had until they aren't met, and then we get very unhappy. But expectations like, you're going to tell me that I'm wonderful. You're going to tell me that you love me a lot. You're going to support me whenever someone criticizes me. You're always going to be on my side. You're never going to get angry at me. You're always going to be understanding. Whatever mood I'm in, you're going to match it with your mood. And so when I'm happy and I want to have a good time, you'll also have a good sense of humor. And when I'm depressed, you know, you'll talk me out of it. And when I'm serious, you'll want to have a serious discussion. And so all of my emotional needs you will meet, and you know, we will never quarrel about money, we will never quarrel about religion, we will never quarrel about the children, and we're going to live happily ever after like the fairy tales told us that we would. Do you have those kind of expectations when you fall in love with somebody? No. I'm completely realistic. If you were completely realistic, you wouldn't be in the relationship. Why? Because what's complete realism? I'm a sentient being with ignorance, anger, and attachment. This person is a sentient being with ignorance, anger, and attachment. And we're going to live happily ever after? with all of our ignorance, anger, and attachment? Is that realistic? You bet it is. The whole world screwed up. We're going to be the one couple that our love is going to transcend everything. Yeah. We're really holding on to, you know, Cinderella and Snow White and the whole nine yards, aren't we? Yeah. So, do you think there's a little bit of exaggeration there? Yeah, a few unrealistic expectations. And, you know, the more we hold on to those, yeah, of course we assume the other person knows all of our expectations and that they have agreed to fulfill all of them. Yeah. Have we ever asked them if they're willing to meet all of our emotional needs? If somebody asked you and said to you, I expect you to meet all of my emotional needs for the rest of my life, what would you say? Yeah? I don't think you'd sign up for that. But that's what we expect of the other person. Okay? So there's a lot of, you know, false expectations and fantasy here. And so that becomes a setup for disappointment. And I think we've all had that in relationships at one point or another. True or not true? Some of you are looking at me like, why is she asking that question? I thought I was the only one who had broken love affairs. Okay, so I think, you know, when we have attachment, there's all this hoopla, mental hoopla, which of course creates verbal and physical hoopla. And, you know, we confuse attachment with love, yeah? Because attachment has these expectations. Attachment also has a kind of a checklist, yeah? I love you as long as you fill in the blank. Okay, and so that creates problems. Real love, the kind of love that we're trying to train our minds to have, is one that just wants somebody to be happy because they exist. Not because they fulfill our needs, not because they do this or that or the other thing for us, but simply because they exist. You know? And like they're like everybody else. They exist, they want happiness, not suffering. So let's work for the happiness of all those beings. Okay? So, you know, the best way to overcome this kind of clinging attachment is to try and get rid of the expectations and then see the person as they really are and wish them happiness simply because they exist, not because they're doing something for you in one way or another. Okay. This takes a lot of contemplation. Yeah, it takes a lot of letting go. But if we can do it, then the relationships usually turn out much better. Okay? So, you have to meditate on this many times. If you just, like he applied the antidote a few times, then he's saying his mind is grasping even stronger. So you have to really apply it many times and really think deeply about how your mind works, you know, what's the nature of a relationship when you have ignorance, anger, and attachment, and so does the other person. Yeah? And we have to look at it in a realistic way. I think many of us, you know, we see the person and they're so wonderful. There's, you know, they may have a problem with anger, they may have a problem with this, but they love me so much that they're going to change. You ever thought that? Yeah, they love me so much they'll change. Or an alternative on that is, I love them so much that I'm going to help them to change. I'm going to save them from their faults. And of course, they'll listen to me as I save them. So we get into a lot of jams that way, you know, all these kinds of expectations. So rather just, you know, seeing this as a sentient being, good qualities, yes, difficulties, yes. Yeah, and so having the mind that wants them to be happy, working, you know, trying to help them, but accepting that you just may not be able to change them. Yeah, even though you have the design in your mind for how they could be even more perfect than they already are. Yeah, they may not want to listen to our advice. Just something to consider. Of course, they have lots of advice for us, how, because we're perfect, but how we could become more perfect too. If we only did this and did that and the other thing. And what do we say when they tell us how we should change to become more perfect? Yeah? What do you say? Do you say, yes, of course. Yeah? I will do everything you ask me to do. Or do you say,
in this lifetime.
Yeah, not in this lifetime, or I won't even repeat it, what you say. Okay, second question. I also am very attached, because we've been talking about attachment as part of the cause of our difficulties. I am also very attached to the concept of being comfortable. Anybody else attached to being comfortable? Yeah? I think being comfortable is way more important than even my health at times. What antidote to this type of attachment would you recommend? Okay, so we're attached to being comfortable. We want the right meditation cushion, right? So that nothing hurts when we sit on it. The perfect meditation cushion. Yeah. The room has to be the perfect temperature. The bed has to be soft enough, but not too soft. Hard enough, but not too hard. Okay. We only have to see, we're supposed to see beautiful things, hear beautiful sounds, only nice smells, only the food we like. Yeah. And you know, we're supposed to be able to sleep as much as we want, to eat whenever we feel like it, to come to Dharma class and just stretch out on the floor and listen when I feel like it. And when I don't, take a nap. Okay, because my comfort is more important. Well, he said even than his health sometimes. Yeah? So what are the disadvantages of having that kind of attitude? What happens?
You're going to be disappointed an awful lot.
What?
You're going to be disappointed an awful
You're
lot.
You're going to be disappointed an awful lot. Because things are never going to be as comfortable as you want. And even they are, you're comfortable for a while, but after a while, what was comfortable to you now becomes painful. Okay? You know, at night you lie down on your bed, it's like, oh, how nice this is. Okay. Now, what happened? What would happen if you couldn't get up from your bed for 24 hours? That you had to stay lying in your bed? Would all 24 hours lying down be pleasurable? Or after a while, would you want to sit up or stand or walk or do something else? You would, wouldn't you? Yeah. So then maybe you stand up and you walk for a while. Oh, it feels so good. But after you walk for a while, you get tired. You want to sit down again. Yeah? So if walking were really happiness, the more you walked, the happier you would be. Just as if lying down were real happiness, the more we did it, the happier we would be. Okay? But we see that the things that bring us comfort, if we do them long enough, make us very uncomfortable. Okay? So that's one thing to contemplate, to reduce the attachment to comfort. Another is to think about the disadvantages of being attached to comfort, what we say to people, what we do to people, what our attitude is towards others when we're very attached to being comfortable. You know, when you really want to be comfortable and you can't get what you want. Yeah. You know, like when you really want to go to sleep and you've been up too long and you haven't been able to sleep. Are you pleasant to be with? No. We become like cranky two-year-olds, don't we? You know? We become very unpleasant. We nag, we pester, we bug other people, we get mad. Yeah. So this kind of attachment to our own comfort brings these kinds of problems. If we were overtired but we weren't so attached, we could just say, okay, I'm too tired right now. That's just the way it is. You know, hold on, I don't need to take it out on everybody else around me. But when we're very attached and we want, you know, to get some sleep immediately, then we become very irritable and unkind to the people that are surrounding us, don't we? Yeah. Okay, so thinking about the disadvantages is often a good antidote to overcome the attachment to comfort. And also thinking of what else you could be doing with your time that is more valuable besides complaining and feeling sorry for yourself and dreaming about, you know, the perfect situation that you want to be in. There's many more creative things we could be doing with our human intelligence. Okay, then, so that was one person's question. He, by the way, wanted to come to the retreat, but wasn't able to. Okay. So now from another one. Okay. So this person is asking, it's a mother. Yeah, saying, what is the correct view to take as a mother regarding her child who is in a homosexual relationship? Given that the Bible, the Quran, and the Lamrim Chenmo seem to agree that a homosexual lifestyle results in going to or rebirth in a hell realm, a mother is left with great concern. The Dalai Lama, in an interview with Larry King, seems to say that LGBT lifestyle is none of his business, but if one is following a spiritual tradition, one should follow the values of one's chosen religion. Okay, and as an adjunct to that, would a Buddhist practitioner attend her child's same-sex wedding? And I have been told by somebody, a Lamrim scholar, that it would be ill-advised for my daughter and her partner to sleep together in my home. Okay! So the precept or the advice about unwise and unkind sexual behavior has to be put in the context of culture at any particular time. Okay? In ancient India, there was one culture. Our culture nowadays is very different. Yeah. In ancient India, for example, The women were basically the property of men. And so I remember being at, so women were basically the property of men. Men, you know, could go to prostitutes, they could go to courtesans. And I remember being in a teaching where one Lama said, when he was talking about unwise and unkind sexual conduct, that if somebody else pays for a prostitute but you sleep with her, then that's a transgression. I nearly went through the ceiling with that one. You know, that prostitution is just accepted, that it's not seen as, you know, women being objectified and made into sexual objects, that, you know, the amount of, trafficking of human beings due to prostitution, the amount of young girls, you know, forced into prostitution, and on and on and on and on. You know, none of that was mentioned. None of, you know, prostitution was, like I said, I nearly went whoop right through the ceiling. So that's a good example of how, you know, in one culture, at one historical moment, what is unwise and unkind sexual behavior is very different than what it is at another moment. Yeah. In Tibet, it was run-of-the-mill for men to have, for women to have more than one husband. Yeah. And it was a way of keeping property in the family. Because if a woman had husbands who were brothers, then all the family property would be together, you know, in one thing, and all the children would be together and inherit the property. That was completely culturally acceptable. I don't think it would go over well here, you know, just as their view of prostitution would not go over very well in our culture, okay? In ancient India, you know, homosexuality, they had a totally different view about it than people do nowadays. Yeah. And, you know, Vasubandhu, who lived in the 3rd, 4th century, he put in a lot of the details about you should do this and you shouldn't do that. And a lot of that was, again, according to the culture at that time, according to the way people lived at that time, and it doesn't fit our culture and our standards now. Okay? So His Holiness can't come out and say, I don't follow Vasubandhu, because he is one of the great Buddhists, you know. But he also realizes that he can't say, I do follow Vasubandhu, because that would, you know, for many of his students, that would just be too much, you know, whether his students are gay or straight. Doesn't matter, because they have, you know, especially the Western students, we have a very different view on this. So I think he just said it's none of his business, which I think is very smart. The view that Western teachers have, you know, almost all of us, it's like, you know, what you do in your bedroom is your business, as long as you're not hurting somebody. Yeah. If you're, you know, having unwise sex and not, you know, using condoms when there's a chance of spreading disease, or if you're using somebody just for your own pleasure without caring for them as a human being, then that's not very wise and it's not very kind. But whether you're gay or whether you're straight or you're bi or you're trans, it really doesn't matter. Okay, that's the way most of us feel. So, you know, here, I wouldn't agree that people who have homosexual lifestyles are going to have a rebirth in hell. I don't agree with that. You know, because there's so much more to a person than what they, who do, you know, the amount, our politics are so focused on what people do in their bedroom, you know? And so much politics about sex, you know, which is ridiculous. We have so many problems in this world to solve. And why are we focused on something like that? That and where people go pee-pee? You know? I mean, that this is, you know, front page headlines, where you're allowed to go pee-pee? Give me a break. Yeah? I mean, I really don't think these things are very important concerns for us to contemplate. We should be thinking about war and poverty and bigotry, yeah, and these kinds of things, okay? So, to this mother, I think you can relax. What's most important is if your child is a good human being with a kind heart and keeps and has an ethical lifestyle. They don't kill, they don't steal. You know, they're not just using people sexually, sleeping around, you know. They're not harming other living beings. So as a mother, don't worry about it, you know. And I think, you know, if your daughter has a loving relationship with her partner, it doesn't matter if they're together in the same bedroom in your house or the same bedroom in somebody else's house. It's like, you know, it doesn't matter whether they're straight or gay. I mean, to me, it's just, you know, attend your child's same-sex wedding? Of course! That's your child! You know, don't you want your child to be happy? Don't you rejoice that your child found somebody, you know, that they have a good relationship with? I mean, sure, go, rejoice, support your child. That's what I have to say about it. Who you talk to in Dharamsala may have something else to say about it. Yeah, but it's very interesting in Tibetan culture, you know, when they talk about the monasteries, if you bring up homosexuality, no, there's no homosexuality in Tibetan culture. No, none, zero. Right? Just as there is no discrimination against women in Tibet at all. Women are equal. You know, so often, you know, every culture has their own blind spots where you can't see things. Yeah? So that's their cultural blind spot. We, of course, have our cultural blind spots too, don't we? Yeah, where we just think, we just think democracy is wonderful and everybody should be democratic and we should invade their country and make them democratic so they could be free. Yeah, that's our cultural blind spot, isn't it? Okay, I should get off my soapbox. Anybody have comments or questions? About this?
I remember Dagmar Lott 2 years ago when she was doing retreat, and I talked to her, and she told me, you know, as a Buddhist Lama, Dalai Lama, she performs gay wedding ceremonies in Seattle.
Oh, that's very nice. This is Dagmo Khushu, who was the wife of the late Dakchen Rinpoche, who was a very very highly regarded Lama. That's very good. I didn't know that Dagmar Lott did that. Yeah. Anything else? Okay. Now we'll go to the actual teaching. Okay. So here we are, afflictive views. Yeah. So, like I said, this is the sixth of the six root afflictions. So the six, the five afflictive views, the view of a personal identity, the view of extremes, we talked about these two last time, so I'll only go through them briefly. wrong views is the third. View holding wrong views as supreme, and view of rules and practices, or view of ethical conduct and observances. Different ways to translate it. Okay, so the first one, the view of a personal identity, so that is the one that, according to the Prasangika Buddhist tenet system, is grasping at a person as being inherently existent and is part of ignorance and is part of the root of samsara. Okay? Because this view does not focus on the aggregates, it focuses on the mere I, but grasps the mere I as being some kind of concrete thing. So this is the part of ourself that thinks, you know, when we have a strong emotion, that thinks, me, I exist, I am here, I want happiness. That whole view, how we hold the I, that's what this one is here. Okay? And the thing is, it's very hard to realize because we are so used to, you know, digging in our heels and having this very strong feeling of me, that we don't even recognize it when it comes up, let alone think that it's an afflictive view, let alone think that it's the root of our wandering in cyclic existence. Instead, we think this very strong notion of me, you know, is good because I've got to defend me and I've got to get what I want. And I deserve to be angry, and I deserve to get what I want, and I'm the best, or I'm the worst, or I, commonly known to as I. Yeah, that's what it brings. Okay, but it's a completely unrealistic view of ourself, okay? Because whereas we are actually a being who exists dependent on many causes and conditions, dependent on our body and mind, dependent on a mind that conceives and labels us, you know, whereas we exist in a dependent way, this view of the personal identity feels like we're absolutely independent. Yeah? Can you find that view of yourself? Here am I. You know, do you ever think I exist only because the causes for me exist? Has that thought ever entered your mind? That I exist only because the causes of me exist? I don't know about you, but I never thought that. I exist because I'm here. I am here. What are you talking about? I'm not a dependent phenomena. I'm here. So that's this view. So it's very problem-causing, because when we hold on to ourself, looking at ourself like that, then, of course, you know, this I becomes the most important thing in the universe, and we become quite attached and grasping at everything that pleases us. We get upset and angry at everything that displeases us. We compare ourselves with others, and we either get jealous or we get conceited. Yeah, so this view is a problem. Okay? The view of the extremes, that's the second one. So this one also is an afflictive intelligence, and this one refers to that inherently existent I that was at that our mistaken notion of the view of the personal identity apprehends. And because, you know, the view of the personal identity, we have this thing that I'm here, I'm real, you know. I'm not impermanent, I'm here. Okay, so it's number 7 there. The extreme view considers the self as perceived by the view of the personal identity and sees it as either eternal or subject to annihilation. So what this means is we have this feeling of me. I'm here, an independent entity. Then, what's going to happen at death? Yeah? And so we usually, after we grasp ourselves as this very concrete independent entity, then when we think, what happens to me at death? Then we think either, there's two choices, either I go totally out of existence and there's nothing, I totally cease, or this self that I grasp at is some kind of permanent soul or self that's going to exist forever without changing. Okay? So based on that wrong view of who we are, the view of the personal identity, then we think at death, either there's a soul that goes on, or I cease to exist. Both of those are incorrect. Okay, both of those are said to be extreme views, because first of all, there's no permanent independent self to exist to start with. So such a self can't, pick up out of one body, go kerplunk in another body without changing. Yeah. So this idea that we have, that many of us were brought up with, that we have a soul that is uniquely us, something unchanging that is, always, that is eternal. When you actually start to look at that idea of a self with reasoning and with logic, it becomes very difficult to actually defend it and to prove that there's some kind of permanent soul or self that's me. Okay? So that's why it's an extreme view. The other one is more of you going to the other extreme of the mind is just an emergent property from the brain. So when the body dies and the brain stops, then the mind finishes. There's nothing. Yeah. And so in our society, when you ask people about what they think happens after death, you usually get one of these two extreme views. One of either annihilation or the other one of permanence or eternalism. Okay? Buddhism talks about rebirth, but we say that there's not an independent, permanent soul that is reborn. Rather, there's moments of mind, one moment of consciousness, giving rise to the next moment of consciousness. So the mind itself being a completely transitory thing, a completely dependent phenomena, dependent on causes and conditions and parts and so on. And so there is a continuity that goes to the future life. But the person is not exactly the same because the mind is not exactly the same moment to moment. Okay? But it's not totally destroyed because there is this continuity whereby the actions we do in one life affect what we experience in the next life. Okay? Is this semi-clear? Yeah. The idea being that if we were a permanent, independent entity, then there would be no cause and condition. We wouldn't be affected by conditions. We wouldn't change. If our consciousness, let's say, or even our body didn't change, I mean, are you willing to say that you haven't changed at all since you were born? We can't say that. Yeah, our body is completely different than when we were born. Our mind is completely different than when we were born. But there's a continuity. Okay? So there's no permanent independent soul, but it's also like We can't say there's nothing. There's a continuity, but each moment of that continuity is different than the previous moment. Okay? So that's why this one's called an extreme view. Okay. The next one, and this is holding to the superiority of views, is an afflictive understanding that observes the aggregates of the view of blah, blah, blah. Okay. Yeah, that sentence doesn't make much sense. I'm not real happy with the translation here of this text, but I don't have the Tibetan. I can't really look at it. And my Tibetan also isn't fantastic. Anyway, what this one is this is the mind that holds wrong views as supreme. So the first two view of the personal identity and the extreme views. This one says these are the best views to have. And not only these, but the wrong view, which is the next one. Now, here, this list is different than the order is just, here the wrong view is the 10th. But sometimes the order is different. But anyway, this one of view holding wrong views as supreme, it says my wrong views are the best views to hold. They're 100% correct. Okay? So if you have that kind of view, that what you believe is 100% correct, are you going to investigate your wrong views of who you think you are? No. Yeah, you're going to stay stuck in all your wrong views, defending them, and that is going to really put a very difficult barrier to progressing along the path. Because we're digging in our heels and we're saying, my view of who I am is accurate, my view of what happens after death, is accurate, everything I think is true. Why? Because I think it. That's going to be difficult. Okay? Then, the next one here, the view of rules and practices is an afflictive understanding that considers these wrong practices to be paths to liberation. Okay, so this is a view. It's also translated as view of ethical conduct and observances. And what this means is you're focusing on either ethical conduct, which here it translates as rules, or observances, where here it translates as practices. You're holding what is not the cause of liberation or the cause of a good life as being the cause of a good rebirth or the cause of liberation. Okay, that's the first part of it. And the second part of it is seeing, having wrong views about practices and religious observances. Okay, so the first one is, for example, at the time of the Buddha, people believed in rebirth. Yeah, so that's fine. But some people had the wrong idea about rebirth. And because they had some, either maybe their teacher said them, or maybe they had some mistaken kind of clairvoyance, they thought that if you acted like an animal, for example, that used up all your negative karma to be born as an animal in your next life. What do you think? Yeah? Do you think that's the cause for having a good rebirth? So there were people who would come. When you read the suttas, there's people who would come like crawling on all fours, acting like a dog, lapping up water, sitting in a curled position, barking, acting like a dog, thinking that used up all their karma to be reborn as an animal so that in their next life they would have a good rebirth. Okay? Completely wrong idea about ethical conduct. Totally wrong idea. Okay? In other cases, there are people, and we even see this today, you know, like Jim Jones. Remember him some years ago? He had all of his followers commit suicide together. And I think the idea must have been that somehow committing suicide was a virtuous action that would bring you happiness afterwards. Yeah, and these people believed it and they followed him. Committing suicide is not the cause of happiness. It's the cause of suffering. Okay? Also, I mean, we find all sorts of things. You know, that people think, some people think that doing very severe ascetic practices, either, you know, starving yourself, maybe self-flagellation, something like this. This happens in Western religions. Yeah, that somehow torturing your body is going to cause you to have spiritual realizations, because torturing your body is going to make you less attached to your body. That doesn't work. That's not ethical conduct. You know, ethical conduct is what leads to a happy rebirth. Not self-torture, not suicide, not acting like a dog, okay? You know, so there's all sorts of views. You can read about some of them in any New Age newspaper or even a regular newspaper, you know? Teachers who talk about all sorts of weird things, saying that it's the cause of happiness and it's not. So that would be, for an example, of, you know, one of these views. Then the one about practices of, or observances is thinking that a practice such as bathing in the Ganges River, drinking holy water, you know, that this is going to purify your karma. Now somebody's going to say, but, in Tibetan Buddhism, actually, in all kinds of Buddhism, everybody has blessed water. So what are you saying, that thinking that blessed water is going to purify your negative karma? Why are you saying that's the wrong view when the Buddhists do it too? Good question, huh? Isn't it? Don't you think? Okay, my view on this is that people are very externally focused. Yeah. We think the cause of our happiness and suffering is something outside of us. So we grasp at external things, thinking that they will bring us happiness. So it would be a wrong view if you thought that this blessed water was going to purify your negative karma. Drinking the blessed water is not going to purify your negative karma. What purifies our negative karma is if we regret our non-virtue, yeah, we generate positive attitudes towards those who we acted horribly against, that we make a determination not to do it again, that we have some kind of remedial conduct. These things will purify. When we drink the water, we think, yeah, I really regret my negativities. Yeah, I want to have a good attitude towards whoever I harm. I don't want to act like that again. So what's important is not the water, but how you think when you drink the water. Hey, you getting what I'm saying? Because if the water acts as a cause to help you remember to think in a way, in a constructive way, okay? People ask me sometimes, I have this very faded red cord that's frayed, that's around my wrist, okay? Why are you wearing that? Okay? His Holiness Dalai Lama gave an initiation last year. These cords are part of the material passed out during the initiation. And it's said to be a cord that reminds you of Maitreya, who's, you know, a Buddha to come, And Maitri means love. So the cord is to remind us to have a mind of loving kindness. Yeah, so that when you look at it, you know, you're getting really ticked off at somebody and you see the cord and it's like, loving kindness, loving kindness, loving kindness, I need to change my mind. Okay? So the cord is not going to help, you know, the cord itself is not going to protect my mind. It's how I think when I remember the cord that does it. Okay? One Lama said, which I thought was very good, because we also have these other ones that we wear around our neck. They're called protection cords. Okay? People, you know, when you're in Asia, people go bonkers. Also in the West. You know, people, Western, East, doesn't matter. People want a protection cord. You know, this string is going to protect me. And I remember one Lama saying, how can this string protect you when you have to protect it because it's going to break? Yeah? So the string is not going to protect you, but the string symbolizes the unity of dependent arising and emptiness. The dependent arising and emptiness come to the same point. When we remember dependent and arising and emptiness are complementary, that view protects our mind from negativity. So the string is a reminder to think about dependent arising and emptiness. Otherwise, if we think that this string is going to protect us from something, you know, we're wrong. Okay? It's how we think. Yeah? So similarly, you know, with these things, it's how you think during all of them. Yeah? And because our thought, our motivation, our way of thinking is really the key thing. So we have lots of things that are external reminders to us. We have blessed water, we have strings, we have pills. Yeah? I'll give you some at the end of the retreat. Yeah? But the pills, but it's very interesting because the pills were made in Dharamsala from herbal substances and also relic substances. And then all the people gather in the community and they say the mantra Om Mani Padme Hum, the mantra of the Buddha of Compassion, millions and millions of times, you know, in thinking that they're putting their own compassion and the compassion of Chenrezig, that Buddha, Chenrezig, yeah, into the pills. So I think also there may be something that happens by the power of the mind when we really meditate very strongly on compassion and say the mantra of compassion, that somehow the mind could affect the pills in some way. Yeah. But again, the real blessing you receive from them is if you think about compassion when you take them. If you're not thinking about compassion, then, you know, maybe there is some benefit from the side of the pills, but not so much. The real thing is how we think. Anyway, okay, I think you get the idea. Yeah, another thing about this one of wrong practices, wrong observances, is relating to the ancient Indian view of the Brahmins, which is when you do a rite, everything has to be said exactly correctly. All the words have to be pronounced correctly, in the correct order. If anything is mispronounced or two words are mixed up, then, you know, the whole rite doesn't make sense. So this is a view that was commonly held in Brahminical India, and many people hold this kind of view also in our culture, that if you do a ritual perfectly, that ritual will purify your negative karma or, you know, bring you some good luck or whatever. But if you, you know, don't do the ritual perfectly, then something, you know, you don't pronounce everything exactly correctly, then there's no use to it. And again, that's a wrong conception. Yeah, because the most important thing when you're doing any ritual is what you're thinking. Yeah. Otherwise, you know, they have in Singapore, it's so sweet. Well, sweet. But you have these little things where it plays Namo Amitofo again and again. So people just, you know, they are too busy to do any chanting and meditation themselves. So they turn on the little thing and, you know, and it chants Namo Amitofo all day and all night. Okay. So if we look at chanting or any kind of ritual like that, that the power is just, you know, your mind can be completely in another place, but because you're doing Namo Amitabha, Namo Amitabha, Namo Amitabha, Namo Amitabha, 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 you know, but as long as you're saying Amitabha is virtuous and you're going to have a good karmic result, you know, I don't think it's quite like that. Yeah. Again, it's what's going on in our mind when we are doing the ritual. Yeah. Not if we do it completely, 100% perfectly. Yeah. Of course, it's good to do it correctly, you know, because there is a certain psychology to a ritual. And if we start making up our own rituals and changing the text to be what we want it to be, then, you know, the whole psychology behind it gets dismantled. So it's good to try and follow how it's set out because it has a certain purpose. But the most important thing when you're doing it is what's going on in your mind. Okay. Then, the last one is wrong view. An afflictive understanding that falls into denying what exists and affirming what does not exist. Okay, so here, these kind of wrong views are about things that are important regarding your spiritual path. Okay, so wrong views are different than doubt, and they're different than curiosity. Wrong views is a very skeptical, almost cynical, digging in your heels, saying, I believe this, and it's your responsibility to make me think differently. But I'm not going to listen to anything you say anyway, because you're wrong. Okay? You got this, the picture of what wrong views are like? Okay? So, when we say that wrong view denies exists something that does exist, it denies the existence of something that does exist, that would be like denying that Buddha, Dharma, Sangha exist, saying that enlightenment is impossible because sentient beings are inherently selfish. You know, saying cause and effect doesn't work. You know, I know for sure there's absolutely positively no rebirth, and if you believe in that, you're a jerk. You know, these kind of very rigid views are wrong views. Being on the fence regarding rebirth, that's not a wrong view. You're on the fence. Yeah? Your mind is open. You're thinking about it. You're inquisitive. Wrong views is like, you know, very tough, cynical mind. An example of asserting the existence of something that doesn't exist, that kind of wrong view, is like saying that there is a creator God who created us, and that the path to liberation is pleasing God, you know, and like that. Yeah. Because there is, you know, from a Buddhist viewpoint, no permanent creator, no absolute creator, like that. Okay, at the Buddhist time, there were lots of different religions and religious sects and wandering groups and all. They all had their own views. Okay? So, one of the sutras, called the Brahmajala Sutra, the Buddha mentioned some of these wrong views. So I'll just read you a synopsis of them. Okay, so there are the eternalists who proclaim the eternity of the self and the world. In other words, there's a permanent soul, the universe is permanent, everything's permanent. Yeah, okay. Then there's those who are partly eternalists and partly non-eternalists, who proclaim the partial eternity and the partial non-eternity of the self and the world. So this would be like saying everything's eternal and permanent on one level, but on another level it changes. Okay? Sometimes we actually think like that. Then there's the finitists and infinitists, I guess people, yeah, who proclaim the finitude or infinitude of the world. Okay, so some people who say the world is finite, you come to the end of the universe and there's a brick wall, okay, and the infinitists who say everything's infinite, and I don't know what else they say. You know, that, I don't know what else they say. I mean, things are infinite, but they must have others, some kind of wrong view attached to that. Okay, so there's those. Then there are the eel wigglers. Eel, like, you know, the eel wigglers, who resort to evasive statements. Because like somebody who's trying to hold an eel, the eel wiggles, you know? So these people, if you ask them a question, you know, is it like this? They go, no, it's not like this. It's kind of like that. And then you say, well, is it like that? No, it's not like that. It's kind of like this. And they always, we have, what's the English word for it?
Politician.
Yeah, okay. So that kind of person. What do we call it? There's a word. I can't think of it right now. Yeah, like equivocating. Yeah, somebody who's equivocating all the time. Okay, then there are the chance originalists who proclaim the chance origin of the self and the world. So these would probably be like many mathematicians or scientists who say consciousness is just chance. Yeah, everything came into existence just randomly by chance, and everything happens by chance. But these are also people who believe in some kind of cause and effect. So I don't quite understand how you put cause and effect together with randomness, but they must have a way to do it. Okay, then another are those who are speculators of the past, having fixed views about the past. Okay, those who are speculators about, who have fixed views about the past. Let's stop there. So these are like the people who say, oh, this whole parallel universe thing. You know, like there's a parallel universe and the past is still happening. So if we could take a time machine and go back into the past and redo it or go into our parallel universe and change things. You know, a lot of people believe in this. My dad had Alzheimer's. Yeah, he believed in a parallel universe. He lived in a community named Newport Beach and he thought there was a second Newport Beach. Yeah, and what that looked exactly like the first one. He had Alzheimer's. Yeah, I mean, this is what he thought. We kept saying, no, there's only one Newport. Oh, no, there's the second one, you know? And my house is not this one that I'm in. It's in my house is in that other Newport, the parallel universe, Newport Beach. Yeah? Stopped arguing with him about that. It didn't do any good. We just loved him, that was all. Okay, so people who have, those who are speculators about the past, having fixed ideas about the past. Then there are those who claim a doctrine of conscious post-mortem survival. Okay, so your consciousness survives after death. Maybe like, you know, your consciousness rises up out of the body and then it looks down at everything and says, you know, where shall I be reborn? Something like that, maybe. Okay, then those who proclaim a doctrine of unconscious post-mortem survival. I don't know what their views are. Yeah? So maybe you survive after death, but you're unconscious? Something like that? Then there are those who proclaim a doctrine of neither conscious nor unconsciousness, unconscious post-mortem survival. Yeah, so again, equivocating. Annihilationists who proclaim the annihilation, destruction, and non-existence of beings. That's like scientific reductionism. Okay, and those are proclaimers of a self that realizes nirvana here and now. But while there is a self that realizes nirvana here and now, they're referring to a self-existent self that realizes nirvana. So that kind of view. Okay, so as we can see, there's many kinds of wrong views. And it's very interesting, you know, when we look at the religious landscape, now there's a whole thing about, what do they call it? If you believe you will be materially prosperous, a lot of kind of evangelical churches believe that. There's a term. Anybody remember what it is for it?
The intention, sort of.
What?
The intention. If that's your intention, then it will be provided.
Yeah.
It will exist.
Right. Yeah, there's a special name for that kind of belief. I can't.
Prosperity doctrine? Yeah.
What?
Prosperity.
Oh, yeah, prosperity something.
Yeah.
Prosperity doctrine, yeah.
Prosperity gospel.
Yeah. So something like that. The idea being, okay, that if you believe in whatever that church is saying, then you will be rich and prosperous in this life. Okay? That's kind of, and not only will you be rich and prosperous if you adhere to these beliefs, but if you are sick, you will be cured of your illness. Okay? So these are some kind of wrong views, aren't they? You know, I mean, our world is still full of many, many wrong views. So it's not, we shouldn't look at people and say, oh, they have wrong views, how stupid they are. You know, that's not a thing to look down on, but just to see that, you know, people often believe what feels comfortable to them without thinking about whether it makes sense. And Buddhism is very much something that emphasizes we have to think about it, we have to investigate, we have to see if it makes sense. We don't just blindly believe. Okay, so those are the six root of afflictions. Okay, any questions about them? What I just read was from the Brahmajala Sutra. Yeah? I think it's in the long discourses. It's one of the long discourses in the Pali Canon. Maybe even the first one in the Devanagari Nikaya. I'm not sure. Yeah?
Oh, I just missed the name of the last one that you mentioned.
The what?
The last one on the list that you mentioned.
Oh. Oh, the ones who adhere to the idea of a self who attains nirvana here and now, but they're thinking that the self is an independent, concrete self, so it's a wrong view.
Mm-hmm. I think when we are holding on to a view, it's already a fault, right? Whether it's a wrong or right view.
Well, we want to generate, we want to have correct views, okay? So a lot of our practice is involved in learning and then thinking about these different things and seeing if they make sense. Yeah. If we have a correct view, but our ego becomes attached to our view, the view is still correct, but our mind is filled with attachment or conceit. Okay? So it doesn't mean that you abandon the view. It just means you have to rebalance your mind so that you can still listen to other people's ideas and respect other people and so on. And so that you don't get defensive. One of my teachers said, you know, you learn Buddhism and then you go home and then people criticize the Dharma and you get defensive. Oh, you can't criticize the Dharma. Buddhism is perfect. That's my spiritual path. How dare you criticize? He said, if you react like that, then, you know, there's nothing wrong with Buddhism, but your attitude and the way you're holding it is something afflicted. Yeah.
So is the personality view separate from the ego and the conceit that is eradicated during arahantship?
Okay. The word ego in Buddhism, there's no Sanskrit, Pali, Tibetan, Chinese word that translates it as ego. And even within English, there's so many different definitions of ego. I mean, Freud's definition of ego is very different. I mean, from Freud's viewpoint, ego was something good. It balanced between the id and the superego. How we use ego now can mean many, many different things. So I don't tend to use that word in describing Buddhist doctrine at all.
How about the word conceit?
Conceit, yes. There is definitely... When we talk about one of the forms of conceit is the conceit of I am. I am. Okay? That's one form of conceit. Does that answer your question okay?
Not quite. I guess, I always thought there was some kind of separation between the personality view and that conceit.
They are different.
Yes.
Yeah, they're different. And also conceit, there's many other kinds of conceit besides the conceit of I am. Okay.
Someone asked, if a friend is in a coma and supported by external oxygen support, does consciousness still exist in this person?
Okay, so if a person is in a coma and supported by machines, does consciousness still exist? I don't know. It probably depends on the particular situation. I remember Dakchen Rinpoche, when Terry Schiavi, remember? That whole hoopla with her husband who wanted to let her die and her parents who wanted to keep her alive. Dakchen Rinpoche said about that her consciousness was long gone, because she had been in that coma for a really long time. Then there are stories of some people who were in coma for a long time and then they wake up. So I think you probably have to see it on an individual basis. It's not easy. Yeah. I think it's very good if each of us have a... what do you call it? A life advance directive in which we state what our personal preferences are.
How important is it to realize when practices are being cultural? Since Buddhism is new to the West, is it important to bring with it some of the older cultural
Okay. I personally think that it's very helpful to understand what is Buddhism and what is cultural, just so that we can have the right idea of what Buddhism is. Okay? But, however, Buddhism never exists outside of a culture. Yeah, it always exists in a culture, because we all exist in cultures, don't we? So culture is going to influence how we practice. But the teachings themselves go beyond culture. So I think it is helpful to discriminate what is what, you know, because then it helps sharpen your mind in terms of what to practice and what to avoid. So the main point of tonight's teaching was learn, investigate, think about things, okay? And also look in your own mind and see what kind of views you may be having that are not even conscious, but you're holding to, and investigate those views also, okay? So His Holiness Dalai Lama really emphasized the importance of investigation and reasoning. Okay? Okay, then we'll dedicate.
May the spiritual teacher soon lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous action spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the 3 worlds always increase. Idaṅgaraṇa mandala kamiryatayami.
Due to this merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds of
explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and non-violent actions in the 10 directions, and especially Ashravasti Abhi.